Thank you all for visiting the University of Minnesota Bookstore. Today we welcome Maureen Ogle, historian and author of the new book, Ambitious Brew, The Story of American Beer, a subject that is near and dear to all of our hearts. Ms. Ogle is the author of two other books, Key West, which is the first account of the Florida Island's history and all the modern conveniences, which documents the history of American household plumbing. She specializes in writing about history, and making accessible and entertaining for everyone, something anyone who has ever attempted to sift through scholarly historical writings can surely appreciate. Today, Ms. Ogle will read from and discuss her new book, which is the first ever history of American beer. Please join me in welcoming Maureen Ogle.
Thank you. Is it good? Because I can't really hear myself. Okay. And I'm as tall as he is, so maybe I should take my shoes off. He actually said something I'm just going to start with, and that is, yeah, history does not have to be boring. The word story is in history, and probably most of you have sat through extraordinarily, excruciatingly dull history classes, and it's my job in life to persuade Americans that history is not boring. So here I am, and I'm going to hold up a clean copy of the book, because my reading copy is getting pretty ratty. This is the history of beer in America. The last 150 years of beer, it opens with the German immigrants in the 1840s who really founded the brewing industry. Prior to their arrival, there really weren't any breweries to speak of. And it ends by looking at the last 30 years of beer in America when a new generation of brewers who dubbed themselves the microbrewers attempted to turn the industry upside down. Am I loud enough? Or are you okay? Okay. No, that's okay. I just feel like I'm... Okay. I don't usually get a microphone, so I'm trying to figure... I mean, I've had them, but they're usually pinned on me, so I'm not actually used to talking into a microphone. Let me just say that I'm not a beer geek. I am not associated with any brewery. I've never worked for a brewery. Nobody in my family's ever worked for a brewery. And I knew literally nothing at all about beer when I started this book. So far, I have been denounced as a shill for Anheuser-Busch and every other big brewery. And yesterday, I was called a neoconservative. And I'm still trying to figure out how you get from a history of beer to neoconservatism. I'll figure it out eventually, I guess. But the point is that I'm an historian, I'm not a beer person. So my perspective is that of a complete outsider. At least I tried to keep myself as distant as I could from the subject and still treat it with respect. That's why the publisher latched onto this first ever history of beer in America. There are some other histories of beer in America, but they're loaded with puns about froth and suds and foam. And there's no puns in my book. I think it's a pretty interesting book because there's some fabulous, amazing people in it. And it's a story about human beings. But I really tried to treat beer with respect instead of turning it into something that was humorous. Although I am going to eventually read you the funniest part of the book. At least so far I've been told it's the funniest part of the book. Let me just say a couple more things about the book. I'll read a short passage and then I'm just going to ask you if you have questions because frankly, my opinion, whatever you ask me is probably more interesting than anything I could pull out of my brain. The book does cover 150 years of brewing. And I really didn't know what I was getting into when I started. I had no idea. And a lot of things surprised me, a lot of things. One of them was, and this is going to sound totally hokey and pretty corny, for the first time ever in my life, the intangible concept of the American dream became something tangible and real. We throw that phrase around, American dream, but I never really thought about what it would actually mean to real people. And rather to my surprise, the first third of the book turned out to be about these immigrants who left everything they knew behind, came to the United States, and in many cases created enormous brewing empires. The three largest breweries in the world were in the U.S. by 1890, and they were all being run by guys who basically knew nothing about beer when they started. But they came here and imagined some better life for themselves and proceeded to create that. What's most remarkable about that accomplishment is this. Prior to the 1840s, Americans drank virtually no beer. I know you find that hard to believe because our image, particularly of the founding fathers, is that they were all sitting around fomenting the American Revolution while slugging back tankards of ale. And that's actually not true. They weren't drinking ale. They were drinking either cider or rum. Americans just weren't particularly interested in beer for a number of reasons. And here's a statistic that will put that into perspective. In the 1820s, there were 14,000 distilleries in the United States, most of them by that time making whiskey rather than rum. But there were only 200 breweries. 14,000, 200. You see that beer was not tremendously important to Americans. So when these German immigrants came over here, at first they were making beer for each other, and non-German Americans were not drinking beer. And after the Civil War, for reasons that are discussed in the book, beer became very, very popular with Americans, and some of these brewers became extraordinarily successful. As I said earlier, in 1890, the three largest breweries in the world were in the United States. And they were all less than 50 years old. They all started out as these little rinky-dink operations. You could fit all three of them into this corner of this store with no problem. 50 years later, enormous. And those three were Pabst Brewing, which no longer exists except as a name and tremendous marketing device, Anheuser-Busch, which is still the largest brewery in the world, and Schlitz Brewing, which also doesn't exist except as a brand. And I'd actually defy any of you to find a 6-pack or a 12-pack. I actually found a 12-pack of Schlitz about 3 months ago in the grocery store. It was completely covered with this thick layer of dust, so I don't know what that says about Schlitz. The Prohibitionists came along. Prohibition itself turned out to be this amazing story. I thought that Prohibition began in the 1920s. It did not. It began much earlier than that. By 1909, half of all Americans were already living under some form of prohibition where they could not drink, buy, or sell alcohol by 1909, even though the Volstead Act did not go into effect until 1920. And that destroyed the lives of thousands of brewing families. There went their businesses. What all these people had worked for several generations at that point disappeared. By the time the Volstead Act went into effect, there were only about 180 breweries still open, and most of them failed during Prohibition. They tried to survive by making things like ice cream and ginger ale and baking yeast, and it didn't have much luck because they were competing with companies who already made those products. Had it not been for the Great Depression, I don't think that any of them would have succeeded. Even Anheuser-Busch, which arguably had the deepest pockets and had the most capacity to survive bad times, even Anheuser-Busch was getting close to complete collapse by the early 1930s. And the reason beer came back when it did is because Americans realized that the Depression had started, and one way to get money back into the federal treasury was to open the breweries back up and to bring alcohol back. So beer came back in the spring of 1933. Rather to my surprise, things progressively got worse from there for the brewers who did reopen their doors. Only a few hundred reopened, and they faced the grimmest period in American beer history. I think the big myth about beer is that in the 1950s and 1960s, that evil, rapacious beast, Anheuser-Busch, destroyed all these little brewers and ran almost all of them out of business. That turns out not to be true. The breweries failed because Americans didn't want to drink beer anymore. And by the middle of the 1970s, there were only 44 breweries left in the United States. That's the low point. Only 44, down from 2,000 in 1890, down from 4,000 in the 1870s. Today, there are somewhere between 1,400 and 1,500 beer makers in the United States. In my lifetime, and most of you, clearly before you were born, so your entire lifetime has been defined by what's called the microbrewing revolution. And I actually knew nothing about that because I didn't drink beer. I, This is all I remembered about beer. Sitting at the Vine in Iowa City when I was in college about 5 million years ago, slugging down dime beers. And that was the last time I really drank beer. And then I went to graduate school and a few other things. And this whole microbrewing thing went right over my head. I wasn't even aware that it was going on until I went to research it. And what startled me about it was that I found a mirror image of the story that I had started the book with. I found a new generation of Americans who were not immigrants. A lot of them, frankly, were pot-smoking hippies who started out as homebrewers, who decided to reinvent the brewing industry, and they pursued their own version of the American dream. So I started the book with what I didn't realize I was going to find, a bunch of people who are pursuing the American dream. And at the end, I have this completely different group of people coming from a completely different perspective, that of the counterculture in the 70s and 80s, who did the same thing. I didn't expect to find all that. That's when I started drinking beer, not because I was tired from doing so much work, although I was getting pretty tired at that point because it took me 5 years to do the book. But I interviewed people who are still alive for the last part of the book. Most of the book deals with dead people, obviously, because it's in the far past. And when I got to the end, I started to interview people who founded the microbreweries, people like Fritz Maytag, who founded Anchor Brewing, Ken Grossman, who founded Sierra Nevada, Jim Cook, who is the guy who founded Boston Beer Company, which you know better as the maker of Samuel Adams Lager. And what I discovered was they're some of the most amazing people I've ever met in my entire life. These very smart, very creative, very talented people. And I thought, what? These are people who could be, you know, Fritz Maytag could have been, I don't know, president of the United States. Jim Cook, who's arguably the smartest guy I've ever met in my entire life, could have been Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He has a law degree. So what was it about beer? Why were they doing beer? So for one day, I went to the store. I thought, okay, I'm going to find out what the deal is. And I started tasting beer for the first time in my life, really tasting it, unlike those days back at the Vine in Iowa City during dime beer hours, slugging it down in these plastic cups. And I discovered that beer is an amazingly complicated, varied beverage that doesn't deserve its bad reputation. It's more varied than wine. It's certainly more complex than wine. It tastes fabulous with food. And so now I'm a convert to beer. For better or worse. Thank you. Yes, thank you very much. Let me read you one short passage. I swear to God, I'm not going to bore you to tears if I can find it. I'm not even going to try to do it without my glasses. I tried that the other night. That was a mistake. As I said, these guys who I interviewed, with the exception of Jim Cook, they all came out of the tradition of homebrewing. Homebrewing was actually illegal in the United States until 1978. From repeal until 1978, because of the way the repeal laws were written, through some weird wording in the language, it was illegal, but that didn't stop people from doing it in the 60s and 70s. And in fact, it became a badge of a certain kind of person. And a lot of the homebrewers were hippies, and most of you are way too young to know what a hippie was. You're looking at one. I'm not anymore, clearly, but a million years ago before you were all born. And back then, the hippies, the counterculture had alternative newspapers. I'm guessing there's probably one, and there's probably a free weekly paper in Minneapolis today, and I'm willing to bet money it started life as an underground newspaper in the 1960s and 1970s. And back then, these underground papers were repositories of information on how to live a counterculture existence. You could go to these newspapers and figure out how to make bread and how to make yogurt and how to grow your vegetables and what to do with the feds knock on the door, you know, how to flush the drugs down the toilet and that kind of thing. They're actually pretty interesting reading. And homebrewing was part of this sort of underground newspaper community. If you wanted to learn how to make homemade beer, you could easily read about it in these papers. So this is what one of the people at the time had to say about homebrewing. And these are his words, not mine. I'm quoting mostly from him. So everybody be prepared for a four-letter word. In the early 1970s, a new breed of enthusiasts grabbed hold of homebrewing. Said one of them, "Now that growing your own food, dope, hair, you name it, is hip, it's time to resurrect the dope of the Depression, homebrew." According to him, homebrew inspired what he called good vibrations and a pleasant high. Unlike the rest of plastic mass-produced shit of modern America, he said, homebrew represents an exercise of craft and empowers the politically oriented to retaliate against August Bush and the other fascist pigs who are ripping off the common man. If you're looking for a cheap drunk, he said, go back to Gussie Bush. But if you dig the good vibes from using something you make yourself, plus an improvement in quality over the commercial shit, brew on, brothers and sisters, brew on. There's no way to measure the number of Americans who embraced homebrewing in the early and mid-1970s, largely because it was illegal. So how are you going to count something that's not even legal? But in the summer of 1973, there were enough that the Treasury Department issued a formal warning advising Americans to leave the beer making to the brewers. And in fact, Fritz Maytag told me that one day the feds showed up at the brewery in San Francisco and issued him a formal warning not to talk to the homebrewers. Somehow, God knows how, they'd found out that homebrewers had been coming to him for information about how to make better beer at home, and they told him to back off. Treasury's warning was a bit bizarre, even laughable, given that Senator Sam Ervin was a few blocks away conducting the Watergate hearings into gross illegalities on the part of the Nixon administration. Part of the fun and games of beer in the early 1970s, the big brewers didn't take homebrewing or microbrewing seriously at first. They thought it was pretty hilarious that somebody like Ken Grossman and Jack McAuliffe were running around to junkyards finding spare parts, old pipes and vats and things, and cobbling together breweries and making beer in these little ramshackle joints that, again, you know, you could fit Jack McAuliffe's first brewery back into the corner of that store. But they're taking it seriously now. Not that August Bush the Fourth is worried about being put out of business by a microbrewer, but clearly microbrewing is not a screwball idea. It has taken hold, and today the American brewing industry is the most dynamic, creative brewing industry in the entire world. And that's not my opinion. That's the opinion of beer experts around the world. If you go into a grocery store and want to buy some fabulous beer, even the little town I live in a very small town in Iowa, there's great beer everywhere. So the book is about how we got from there to here and what it means to be an American and how beer itself became American. And I'm going to stop now. Ooh, a little longer than I thought. And if you have some questions, I'll be glad to answer them. I'll ask, how many of you are here for extra credit? Nobody? Yeah, I knew it. I knew it. These three showed up. I thought, extra credit. Okay. All right. Well, you got to admit, it's not that painful, right? Okay. Any questions from anybody? Yeah. Next to nothing. That it's hilarious to go to a microbrewer's meeting or convention because they're all talking about how Anheuser-Busch is out to get them and how Anheuser-Busch is really worried about the competition. In actual fact, craft brewing owns a grand total of 6% of the beer market, and the other 97% is controlled by Busch, Miller, Anheuser-Busch, Miller, Coors. Who's number four? Number four is this marketing entity called Pabst Brewing. There is no Pabst Brewery. It's a brand owned by a holding company, but man, have they figured out how to market beer to 20-somethings. It's amazing. But I also will say that Anheuser-Busch brews something like 110 million barrels a year, and Miller brews 40 million. So between number one and number two is a huge gap. Coors only brews about 12 million, and Pabst, which is frankly starting to fade, I guess the marketing bloom has worn off, it makes like 6 million barrels. So there's an enormous gap between one and everybody else. But craft brewing is a tiny, tiny piece of the market. But to listen to them talk, they rule the world. There's actually a formal definition. The microbrewing industry has divided itself into categories. Jim Cook, who owns Sam Adams, makes about 2 million barrels a year. Dick Yuengling, can you get Yuengling beer here? You probably can't. I don't think it's available this side of the Mississippi River. Dick Yuengling is the president of the oldest brewing company in the United States, D.H. Yuengling & Son in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. He's also one of the grooviest people I've ever met. He makes maybe 1.5 million. The average brew pub. There surely must be a local brewer here somewhere. We're talking somewhere between 50 and 100,000 barrels. So for them, that's great. But yeah, clearly Anheuser-Busch is not too concerned about them. Yeah, yeah.
Did you in your research discover any, I've got some myths floating in my head about kind of the history of beer.
I've demolished all of them.
50 years, we'll see if any of them still hold true. Especially after I read the book. Did you find anything about the effect of anti-European sentiment in the United States and the effect on the beer industry in the 30s and 40s?
Oddly enough, the effect was during World War One, and in fact, I cover that. Sometimes I read that at signings. The prohibitionists seized that particular moment because, of course, most of the all of the breweries in the United States were owned by German descendants. By World War One, they had all been. August Busch was born in the United States. His father Adolphus was not. The prohibitionists took full advantage of anti-German hysteria. They actually managed to hold hearings in which the German brewers were denounced as spies and traitors. It was I just found it devastating to read about, but yeah, it's all documented. They got their revenge in World War II. When World War II started, the prohibitionists immediately said, we need to impose prohibition again. No beer for servicemen, no beer anyway, shut everybody down. The distilleries did have to shut down because it was determined by someone that the industrial alcohol actually was needed for the war effort, but in World War II, Congress declared brewing to be essential to troop morale, and you were actually exempt from service if you worked at a brewery, and the brewers were required to turn over 15% of their output to the troops. So they got theirs back. The bottom fell out as soon as the war ended, but the really nasty, unbelievable anti-German sentiment was in World War I, and it just hastened prohibition. I don't think prohibition would have happened nearly as quickly. I was just astounded by the way these guys manipulated the situation, and these congressional hearings were quite something to read. So yes, that's one thing you'll learn about in the book. Anybody else? There's a lot of myths. I have demolished every myth that's out there, I think, for which I am being lambasted right and left. Because I'll say one, this is kind of interesting about human nature. I didn't realize how important myths are to people. There are a lot of people who are just not going to let go, despite the evidence. And I'm an historian. I use evidence. I documented everything. I didn't make this stuff up. But boy, they're not going to let go. Other questions? Yeah.
How did you get interested in this subject?
I had, in the spring of 2001, the Key West book, which was my second book, went into production. And so I had to think of something new to write about. And, if I'm not writing a book, then I'm essentially not working, and it makes me kind of nervous. And so I was trying to think of something to write about. And I realized that sounds kind of stupid. How tough can it be to think of a book to write about? But it actually is very difficult because you got to come up with something sustainable for this many pages and something that you think a publisher will buy. So I was coming up with all what I thought were these fabulous ideas. And I would send them to my agent. She'd write me emails back and say, Maureen, what is the matter with you? These are the stupidest ideas in the world. So finally I thought, okay. I think I just better back away from this a little bit and maybe my brain will come up with something. Because my other two books just kind of came to me in moments of inspiration. And one day in April 2001, I was driving down the street to the grocery store and about two blocks in front of me, a red truck pulled up to a stop sign at a side street and then crossed the street so it rolled across my line of vision. Red truck, one word on the side, painted in white. The word was Budweiser. And I thought, oh, I wonder if there's a story to be told about beer. And by the time I got home, I thought, oh, well, there's another bad idea, because I was sure there must be at least 500 books, you would think. And I was amazed to discover that nobody'd really ever written a substantive, respectful history. So it came from some, place down in my brain, as did my new book. I've started a new book, A History of Meat. I don't even know where that one. I had this image of the King Ranch in Texas. I don't even know where the King Ranch in Texas is. And that's, the brain is a weird thing. So that's where it came from. I knew nothing at all when I started the book. Nothing. I actually, when I saw that beer truck, I wasn't sure if Budweiser was a beer or the name of a company. And it took me a while to figure out that Anheuser-Busch was the name of the company. So that's how ignorant I was. Yeah.
How would you characterize the previous efforts at brewing history? Would it be like self-publishing?
A lot of them come close to being self-published, and they're written by, and people love this phrase, so I'm not being insulting to anybody by using this phrase. They're written by beer geeks, and beer geeks pride themselves on being beer geeks. And they were not written by historians, and they were written by people who were really close to the subject, and by people who apparently love puns, because every other sentence would be a pun on foam, you know, suds, whatever. And so the difference is, I think that's why the publisher kind of latched onto this first ever. It's clearly not the first, but I am the first person as an historian to look at it. I'm also the first person who's documented the last 30 years of beer. Nobody'd really tried to figure out, you know, how did all that happen? So I think that's the difference, just my outsider status and the fact that I'm a professional historian rather than a beer geek. I really made myself stay away from beer. Like I decided early on not to homebrew. You know, I just made decisions consciously the whole time to stay as distant as I could from the subject itself. Yes, though he's actually Michael Jackson, the unfortunate name of Michael Jackson, not the basketball player, not the guy with the glove. He's a British journalist who's been writing about beer styles for about, he actually started working in the middle 60s, so about 40 years now. And he actually is a little more careful about beer history, although his focus has always been European beer history. But most times if you read a beer history, I discovered a lot of it is just people are just repeating what they read someplace else who are in turn repeating. I'm amazed at how many beer histories have just been lifted wholesale from another book. I'm kind of floored by the amount of plagiarism that people get away with. So nobody really tried to actually look at the myths, try to use, you know, substantive professional research methods. So that I think that's the difference. And as a result, some people hate me and, you know, some people are happy. So... other questions? Yeah.
At what point did you come up with the title?
Oh, God. Titles. Oh. This is Ambitious Brew, the Story of American Beer. That's maybe the 500th attempt at a title. I came up with it through three agonizing days. I thought I had the title of the book. The problem with coming up with the title of the book is you don't really know what, literally, I don't mean this to be funny, you actually don't know what the book is about until you've written the book. But my editor wanted me to come up with a title really early on. And I knew it was going to be about some pretty interesting people. And it just came, 3 days I sat and came up, you know, with I don't know where these things come from, but that's where the title, it came from somewhere down inside my brain. I like the title, actually. What surprised me about the title in the end is that it actually ended up having something to do with the content of the book. Because like the Key West book, I had literally changed the title at the last possible moment. And that happens way more than you'd know, way more. When people are finished the book and they say, oh, God, the book's not what about what I called it. Woo, I need another title fast. So I don't know where it came from, somewhere. Other questions about whatever? Yeah. Well, the one I'm getting just beat up pretty badly, and it's okay with me if I get beat up badly. That actually does, you know, because it's a free country. A lot of beer in this country is made by adding corn and rice to the mash. You start with barley, and then you add either corn or rice. And the big myth about that is that Anheuser-Busch and Schlitz started doing that after World War II. In order to reduce their production costs, the argument being that corn and rice are a lot cheaper, so instead of using fine quality barley, they're adding really schlocky ingredients, and it allows them to completely reduce lower production costs so they can make the beer a lot more cheaply and then sell it to schmucks like you at a high price who are being duped by them. That's the big myth. Turns out that is dead wrong. There's not one bit of truth in that. Brewers actually started adding corn and rice to the beer in the 1860s, right after the Civil War. They did it because they realized that non-German Americans would not drink an all-malt beer. German immigrants were used to drinking a really heavy, rich beer because in Europe, food is scarce, and beer for them was literally part of the food on the table, liquid bread. But in the United States, there was no scarcity of food. Nobody was going hungry, relatively speaking. And the average American wouldn't drink something that heavy and filling. They wanted a much lighter beer. So the brewers tried to emulate styles of beer from Bohemia called Pilsner, which is a much lighter bodied beer than a Bavarian beer. But they discovered they could not do it using domestically grown barley. North American strains of barley just wouldn't work. You ended up with this kind of big hazy mess because there was too much protein and too much starch in the barley. So, and they figured out the only way they could do this was by adding the corn and rice, which would gobble up some of that excess and remove the haze. And the corn and the rice were actually more expensive than the barley. The barley was the cheap ingredient. And the result were these very light-bodied, almost effervescent kind of beers. The classic example is the beer everybody loves to make fun of, and why would August Busch care? Budweiser, which still accounts for 18% of the beer sold in this country. Budweiser was fabulously popular from the moment it came on the market, and there's a very funny story about the original Budweiser in the book about a lawsuit. At least I think it's pretty funny. I had a good time writing about it. So that was the biggest myth, and that's what I'm getting chewed to pieces about. People don't want to let go of their cherished belief that Anheuser-Busch is really ripping off consumers. They just, some people just aren't going to let go of that. So that was the real biggie. Other questions? Yes, yes, yes. Before the Civil War, these breweries were quite small. They were making an all malt, very, very heavy, yeasty beer, but it was being consumed. They were basically making it for other German Americans. And after the Civil War, people like Frederick Pabst and Adolphus Busch, who were not beer makers, they married into beer families. They knew nothing about beer, and I think that's why they were willing to expand their breweries, because they came at this from almost a blank slate. They had no myths of their own to uphold. And so they wanted to appeal to a much bigger audience. They wanted non-German Americans to drink the beer as well. And they had to figure out how to persuade them to do it. And the way they could do that was to make a beer that they were actually willing to drink. And again, nobody was more surprised than me by this. I kind of thought the myths would be true. I didn't set out to bust all these myths. But that's where the great growth of the breweries came from, once these guys figured out how to make a beer that everybody else would drink. They continue to make these all malt beers for, as one person in the book I quote, for the old world crowd. But your average American wasn't interested in drinking these really heavy yeasty beers. And the fact is, microbrewing notwithstanding, they still don't want to drink it. There's a reason that Budweiser accounts for 18%, just that one brand, 18% of the beer sold in the United States. 97% of the beer sold in this country contains corn and rice. You know, 97% of beer drinkers can't be stupid. At least I don't think so. Other questions? Yeah.
Did you run across anything in your research about the current distilling movement? It seems to be parallel.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I didn't know anything about... He's referring to micro distilling. And Fritz Maytag, who owns Anchor, he actually is, as far as anybody knows, he's the first micro distiller. He has a tiny distillery. I just saw it. I was just there. We did an event there about... I don't know. I've lost track. A week ago now, I guess. And it's down in the lower level of the brewery, down in the back. And he got interested in small distilling, and so have a lot of other people. And if you ever get a chance to taste some micro-distilled products, whoa, they're astonishing. They're really... And in fact, Bill Owens, who I also interviewed for the book, who founded the second brew pub in the United States... He's long since gotten out of beer, but he founded a trade group for the micro distillers. There's now enough of them that they have their own little trade group, and he runs this trade group. He doesn't actually distill, but he runs the trade group for them. But there are a lot of really good micro distilleries in the U.S. right now. Their stuff is very hard to find, but if you're out and about and you think you want to taste, liquor on a grand scale. Ooh, delicious stuff. But a lot of these guys, you mentioned Jim Cook, Jim Cook makes the highest alcohol content beer in the world. He makes Utopias. He did not make one this year. He's going to make one for 2007. It has an alcohol content of 28%. And I got to taste it in Denver a few weeks ago, and it is smoother than the best brandy I've ever had in my life. It's just incredible. If you ever think of it, next time he brings out some Utopias, buy a bottle, because it ages and they start going on eBay for ridiculous amounts of money. So if you want to invest in something that's beer, invest in one of these very high alcohol content beers. They're really limited edition, and they do age. They won't go bad. So, and they're amazing. Actually, they're quite amazing. There's a lot of really creative stuff going on right now. Some of it, you know, I had some smoked beer in Denver. I couldn't get too excited about the smoked beer, but, you know, there's a lot of good beer out there. Other questions? For extra credit or otherwise. These guys in the back are saying, man, would she shut up so we can go taste some of this stuff? Yeah.
Talk about any of the regional family-owned.
Yes. Yes. When I got to the last 30 years, one of the things that happened when this microbrewing thing took off, and well, before the microbrewing thing, in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a lot of anti-big sentiment in this country. There was a lot of anti-corporate attitude. Back then, we called it disestablishmentarianism. And all of a sudden, these little brewing families, like the Hubers, who don't own the brewery anymore, and Shell Brewing in New Ulm, and the Leinenkugels across the river, all of a sudden, their fortunes changed. These guys were just hanging on by a thread. They didn't even know if they were going to make it through the decade. And all of a sudden, man, their beer is hip. And there's a very funny story in here about the Leinenkugel family and, you know, the Leinenkugel hysteria suddenly. People are just going insane for Leinenkugel beer. So, yes, I do talk about them. The Leinenkugels, by the way, are about the sweetest people you'll ever meet in your entire life. God, they're nice people. Really, really nice people. And they make very good beer, I think. Here's a funny beer story that involves them and New Ulm, the Shell Brewing. Does everybody know what bracketing is? Most of you, if you're like at the NCAA tournament, you start out with 64 teams and you bracket them, and then they play each other and eventually end up with a final eight, and then you have a final four, and then you end up with a national champion. About a month ago, this guy in New York called my editor and said that he and a friend of his were doing a book of bracketology, and they've asked 100 famous people, I don't know how I fit into this, to bracket their thing of expertise. So, for example, Arnold Palmer is taking 32 golf swings and bracketing them to come up with the perfect golf swing. Heidi Klum, the model, is starting out with 32 kinds of lingerie and bracketing them to come up with the perfect piece of lingerie. Elvis Costello is bracketing Beatles songs that were never number one. And somebody else is bracketing Elvis Costello songs. So they asked me to bracket beer. And at first I thought, oh, God, do I really want to do this? And I thought, well, actually, maybe it would be fun. And it would turn out to be a lot more work than I thought. I'm not trying to, it was really, because I had to, you know, do these taste tests. I started out with 32 beers, and I had to keep tasting them against each other. So finally I got to my final four. Here's my final four. Firebrick from Shell. Leinenkugel Creamy Dark. Abita Turbo Dog. And Saranac Adirondack Lager. And I bet you can't get Saranac here. It's made by the Matt family in Utica, New York. They've been around for well over 100 years. So that was my final four. My final two was Abita Turbo Dog and Saranac Adirondack Lager. And after much agonizing, and I really was having a tough time picking a winner, and I finally thought, okay, what if I were on a desert island? Which beer would I want to drink every day? Which, of course, is a completely illogical concept, because if somebody could bring me beer on the desert island, obviously they could take me away. So, you know, but I finally decided that my sort of classic all-time go-to everyday beer is Saranac Adirondack Lager, but I do recommend Abita Turbo Dog as well. So, yeah, I have had my encounters with the little family breweries. Yeah. Other questions about beer or anything else I can pontificate about at length or otherwise? Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to talk with any of the employees who used to work in breweries?
I did not. I had a lot of them contact me. You know, there's a point at which everybody who writes a book has to keep making decisions. You know, literally every word is a decision, every sentence. The original draft of the manuscript was 175,000 words. This is only 116, the finished product. And, you know, it's one of those things where I thought, where am I going to draw the line? Where am I going to stop? And so I talked to plenty of people who work in beer, tons of people. But I didn't talk specifically to people who worked. Like, I did talk to the Matt family and the Lionel Kugel family and Dick Yingling, and but I didn't talk to any of their employees. Maybe I should have found disgruntled employees. But, you know, I didn't want to get sidetracked either. I needed to kind of stick with what I was doing here, and that was not to... I wasn't out to bash Anheuser-Busch. That was not my goal, so, yeah. God knows there's a lot of people float. I as near as I can tell... Every other white American in this country has at one time been related to a brewer. I'm staggered, which I think is only a way of saying that about every other or every third white person in America is of German descent in some way. I'm amazed at how many people say, oh, yeah, my great-great-grandfather owned a brewery, or my great-great-grandfather was a brewmaster. I'm amazed at how many people have had ancestors working in brewing. It's amazing. Yeah. I didn't. Again, that was one of the kind of editorial choices I made. In fact, I dispatched Colonial Brewing pretty quickly because it was clear to me that if I kept referencing Colonial Brewing, I was really not going to ever get to where I really wanted to go with this. And so I think the connection, well, I'm not actually even sure the connection is all that apt, because brew pubs today are so, they really are different. They're what... I don't think they do, because for one thing, they tend to be more family oriented, and colonial pubs were really for men only. In fact, I was talking to somebody the other day about that very thing, and he said, you know, really the connection between brew pubs today is with the German gardens, the beer gardens that I talk about in chapter two. That's really if they have ancestral roots, they really go back to the German beer gardens of the late 19th century rather than the colonial taverns, I think anyway. Yeah, my stepdaughter actually lives a few blocks from it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's not very many left. There's this place in Portland. I was just in Portland last weekend, and there's a tiny brewing company there called Lucky Lab, and they have two brew pubs. And if you're ever in Portland, go to the Lucky Lab Beer Hall on Quimby. It's up in the northwest part of Portland. And it's maybe the closest thing to a really old-fashioned German beer hall that I've ever been in this country, complete with the long tables and the benches, you know. And what a place that was. It was pretty cool. It's owned by Lucky Lab, which is a tiny, tiny brewing company in Portland. I don't think they have any distribution outside of about a 10-mile radius of Portland. And it's on Quimby, 19th and Quimby. Portland, Oregon, by the way, has more breweries, not microbreweries, but breweries, period, than any city per capita than any city in the entire world, which is kind of an amazing thing. They're quite proud of that there as well. They should be. There's a lot of great beer in Portland, Oregon. I recommend Portland, Oregon, actually. Other questions from anybody? That's it? You sure? Who's in charge? Should I? You want me to sign some? You don't know either, do you? You have no clue, because all the bosses left. They left us here on our own. We should have just gone to whatever bar there is on campus. There you go. Yes, actually, I'm going. I don't know if any of you are going to the Oktoberfest at the campus club this afternoon, but I've been invited. I'm apparently supposed to get up and do like a 4-minute version of what I just got done doing, and eat the best of the worst. So I'll sign some books if you want me to. Thank you very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Because without readers, I'm nothing. So I am enormously grateful. Thank you.